You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey everybody, CJ here. Welcome to episode 164 of the Dangerous History Podcast. And this episode, the meat of it is going to be my conversation with Brett Vinott of the Excellent School Sucks Podcast, which occurred at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest of 2018. If memory serves, I'm pretty sure this conversation took place on Sunday, and we were literally sitting in a picnic table in the middle of a clearing, and you can hear in the background birds chirping and even the occasional dog barking, that sort of thing. So it's really kind of cool. So if you've already caught this as an episode of School Sucks, you don't need to listen to it again unless you really, really want to. I think it's a very interesting conversation, and I think it's a good primer for those of you who have sometimes asked me about my sort of research methodology and that sort of thing. It's mostly Brett kind of interviewing me, so we talk a bit about my background, which you may or may not know much about, depending on exactly which episodes you've listened to of the DHP, and we get really a lot into, and I find it interesting, and many of you may as well, the sort of nuts and bolts of kind of how I do research and how I try to put it together to make podcasts that are hopefully interesting and entertaining, but also informative. So I think it's a very interesting conversation. We talk about a bunch of other things as well. So like I said, if you're already a listener or subscriber to the School Sucks podcast, then you've probably already heard this or may have already seen it in your feed. No reason to be redundant and listen to it again unless you just really want to. And if you're not a listener to the School Sucks podcast, I don't know what the hell is wrong with you, but you should get over there and check it out as soon as humanly possible. It's been on my short list of favorite podcasts for quite a while, actually since even a bit before I started this podcast. And I just want to say huge thanks to Brett for doing this with me. It was really cool not only to have a conversation with someone whose work I've been following and with great admiration for quite a while, but to do it in person and in such a cool venue, you know, outside at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest on a picnic table. I mean, that's just awesome. So I really enjoyed the conversation, and I very much look forward to working more with Brett on some collaborations in the future. So without further ado, my conversation with Brett Vinott.
CJ, welcome to School Sucks.
Hey, it is great to be here.
We are at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest meeting for the first time.
Yes.
I'm kind of a new listener to your Dangerous History podcast. I think it's awesome. I wish there were more alternative histories. I mean, there's no shortage of them, but I really like where you come from on your show. And you're kind of a rare breed.
I like to say I've got the market pretty much cornered when it comes to a history podcast that's from an anarchist sort of perspective.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of anarchist podcasts. Mm-hmm. There are lots of history podcasts, but there is not a lot of places where that Venn diagram overlaps. So I kind of saw an opening, a market opening.
Right.
And jumped into it.
So you are an actual college professor.
That is correct. I am a full-time tenured professor of history.
Indeed. And it's been over a decade, right? You've been doing this?
Teaching college history for 12 years.
How did you develop these philosophical beliefs in such a setting? Or did you bring them into that setting with you?
The origin story question.
Yes.
It's complicated. I came from basically a right-wing family for the most part.
Where'd you grow up?
In South Florida, in the Miami-Fort Lauderdale area.
Yeah.
And I, from pretty early on, started to have serious problems with that ideology.
Yeah, sure.
And kind of two main things that I just couldn't go along with in that ideology. One of them was, at some point very young, I kind of realized that the war on drugs was bullshit.
Okay.
Like that it's pretty messed up that you would throw someone in jail just for, you know, wanting to smoke some weed or whatever. It just, for some reason, I was probably 10 or 12. I was like, this is just messed up.
Right. And if you're not a law and order guy, you're in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing that I just couldn't get on with in that is, in general, just the tendency towards like hardcore religion.
Yeah.
That was something from very early on. I was just like, I don't.
A lot of pressure to do
this
it?
Sort of stuff. Kind of an interesting situation. My parents divorced when I was very young, and so I had the switching back and forth between two households experience, where, you know, I'd be a few days a week here, a few days a week there, and so I had one household that was more strongly religious and one that was more still religious but like more laid back and moderate about it.
Yeah,
but just from very early on, I wasn't buying it.
Right,
I wasn't buying it. I was just like, I just don't believe all this stuff is actually going on. And so
how old are you at this point?
That's hard to say. It's hard to say because it's sort of a gradual thing.
Yeah.
When you're in that situation, when you're raised in a belief system that you start to have doubts about.
Sure.
It's not like a quick like, oh, yesterday I thought all this made sense and today I woke up and realized I don't think all this is true.
Yeah, it comes with a lot of doubt when it's like everything that you're surrounded by and you start to feel differently. It's a lot of self-doubt. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a strange, gradual situation. And actually, I think there's a lot of similarities and parallels for anybody who is both an atheist and an anarchist. There's a similar process of coming to that point of view. Like it's very parallel where you start off with these little nagging things that you're not quite buying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that at least for my personal case, there's a lot of similarities between leaving religion and leaving the civil religion.
Right. Sure.
And it's a similar thing where people kind of think there's something wrong with you.
Oh, sure.
When you leave the group.
Hmm.
So, but that was sort of a gradual process. And I would say by the time that I was going to college, I would describe where my thinking was as sort of conservatarian.
Okay.
Or maybe like mainstream, like LP type libertarian way of thinking.
What were you using to kind of bolster that view or to help you confirm or strengthen these beliefs that you were developing? Like who had your ear or your eyes, I guess, if we're talking about authors at that point in your life?
Oh, that's pretty early on, Ayn Rand. But Ayn Rand, I don't think, was actually as big of an influence on me as a lot of libertarians, because right off the bat, I had problems with Ayn Rand, too.
Oh, of course.
So,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, pretty early on, I could tell that there was this cultiness about her and her followers and whatever, and that immediately put me off. But also, I'm one of these people, I just think that Ayn Rand is a terrible fiction writer.
Yeah, kind of flat characters.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. I found the same.
Yeah, very, very simplistic, and everything's very didactic, and it's just not good fiction. You know, good fiction, you need ambiguity. You need complex characters that have arcs. You can't have these wooden stereotype sort of things.
People who are they're just basically carriers of the philosophy. I think that's the way that I've described it. That's their job. It's not really they lack nuance, that kind of a thing. Wooden. I like the wooden. I've never heard that before. I like that.
Yeah. Sort of cardboard cutout types. But I don't know. I remember reading some like vaguely mainstream-ish libertarian stuff. Like I probably read Road to Serfdom young. And I was a voracious reader from very early on. And I will give my parents credit. My parents very much encouraged me to like self
learn to self. Like they were very encouraging. They would you know take me to the library whenever I wanted to go and you know either hang out there themselves or just leave me there.
Right.
Or you know, and they were always happy to like buy me books in anything I was interested in. So, you know, I just read a lot of different stuff, and I realized like there were parts of the conservative way of looking at the world that I still thought were okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like the overall skepticism about, you know, obviously in practice they don't do this consistently.
Of course, a lot of talk about it,
yeah,
right?
But yeah. The overall attitude of skepticism towards big government and that sort of thing.
Sure.
You know, but then it was a matter of over many, many years working out the contradictions.
Right.
You know, and then somewhere along the way, I finally, it's kind of, again, it's sort of a similar thing, like where people who go from religion to no religion usually pass through this middle ground of kind of deism and like sort of vague, I think there's a supreme being. And then, you know, if they keep going down that path, eventually they get to the point where, yeah, I don't know if there's any of this stuff.
Sure.
And so it's just a similar thing with me happened with politics.
Did you go have like an angry phase? You know, I mean, you talk about, okay, so you talk about atheism and anarchism. So there's a lot of the revelation that you have been given misinformation. And not just given.
Yes.
Like, given is a very gentle word, right?
Mm-hmm.
You say your parents were open to your exploration, open to your independent study. I'd say my parents were too, but they were still the ones that were at one point, you know, making me go to church and not... In my case, anyway, we weren't having really critical conversations about the messaging that I would pick up in like Sunday school or church itself. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, all of the political stuff. For me, it was like post-college. So I remember feeling really angry and like betrayed in a way, not necessarily by my parents, but just by, it was more vague than that, you know, mm-hmm. but there was definitely an angry phase. I can still tap into it from time to time.
Oh, yeah. And I think I went through several, honestly. I think it kind of came and went at different points, sort of as I reached different milestones.
Right.
And if you listen to some of my earlier podcasts, because I've been doing the podcast for about 4 years now, some of the earlier ones, and I think I've seen a similar thing. I know you've been doing it a lot longer, but a similar evolution where some of my earlier podcasts, I was more angry.
Yeah.
And then as time went on, simply having an outlet where I could say what I really wanted to say, there's a certain amount of catharsis and decompression
right.
that happens. And so you're able to get more relaxed about it and like still have these, you know, extreme beliefs that we have, but no longer be that zealot, that fanatic, you know.
I notice that with people who have like very few chances to externalize, you know, in any kind of performance way.
Yep.
And before I started the show, it was, zealot was a good word, you know, and I made people uncomfortable and I was very, very belligerent. And it's just like being able to turn the valve week after week, I think was really therapeutic. It helped me externalize a lot of that stuff. I said, I got some comfort from saying like, okay, it's on record, right? Like I can send somebody this if this topic comes up. And this is like that situation where the confrontation happened in the past isn't going to be like my only chance for somebody or a group of people to hear this information that I feel so compelled to share.
Yes, that sounds very, very similar to the process I went through. And somebody, I want to say it was Winston Churchill, but I could be wrong about that. Somebody once said that the definition of a fanatic is someone who can't change their mind and won't change the subject.
Mm, exactly.
So when you feel compelled to try and correct everybody around you.
Right.
And you haven't yet developed, for lack of a better term, the wisdom to kind of know when to just let things slide.
Right.
You know, that to realize like it's not my job to correct everyone else around me who I think is wrong.
Right.
And to sort of make peace with, you know, a certain percentage of people are just not at all amenable to what you're saying.
So perhaps, I'm going to guess here, as a contrast to this serenity that you've reached now, what was college like? What was being a college student like?
You know, I actually did all right in college, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, you probably heard me mention it a little bit in my talk earlier. But I went to a small liberal arts college, and it was kind of old school in the sense of it was education the way you would think of liberal arts college, you know, generations ago, where it's about taking a lot of courses in a variety of subjects and really getting that kind of well-rounded education where you're learning different subjects and you're kind of making connections between things and you're just becoming sort of a versatile person who is able to engage with a lot of different subjects.
Right.
So as an undergraduate, I mostly had a very positive experience in college. I had a lot of professors who really were what you would hope a professor would be as far as people who were open to students who challenged the course material or challenged even the professor's own interpretation, as long as you did it in an intelligent and thoughtful and you know, civilized sort of way. So I had completely the opposite of the experience that you see in some of the elite schools today anyway. And so I had professors that I could in class express my like gradually radicalizing libertarian leanings, and they were cool with it, even the ones who didn't agree with that at all.
Right.
So I was very lucky in that regard. And then graduate school was a little bit more not up my alley, but even there I was able to strategically kind of make what I wanted out of it.
Talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one thing I encourage anybody, whether they're in, obviously you have fewer options usually if you're like in the public school grade school system.
Yeah.
But even there, you often have more options than people realize to kind of, you know, change things around a little bit at the margins, at least to get better stuff out of it. I had probably above average luck, even in K through 12. It wasn't as bad for me as it is for a lot of people.
Right.
And it was a matter of I tested into gifted very early. And that meant that from first grade on up, I was in a lot of gifted and advanced classes. And that is a different experience.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Because oftentimes the teachers who are teaching those things are the more competent ones who are more enthusiastic and more creative and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. A lot of people I've talked to have had that experience that they actually felt like they were being educated, right?
Yeah. 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 It was certainly a cut above, like there was a lot more options for students to have some choice. I mean, you know, they're still within the limits of the system and whatever, but like a little bit more opportunity for like creative projects and, you know, a little bit more choice in what you wanted to learn about and, you know, within the limits, obviously, of the system overall. So I kind of did a similar thing in graduate school where I was just very choosy about which professors I would take classes with. And, you know, there were a few that I didn't really do my due diligence. And I had a couple classes in graduate school that weren't great, but really a lot of them were pretty good.
How would you vet somebody for something like that?
To
kind of like ensure the best you can that you're going to have a positive experience.
Right. And, yeah. Well, I mean, today we have things that we didn't have back then, like rate my professor.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you have to obviously take that with a grain of salt because sometimes it's sour grapes.
Right.
You know,
right.
Students who they were terrible and they think the professor should have gave them an A, even though they did terrible, you know, a terrible job, and they're just going to, you know, crap all over them. But you can certainly see trends with people who have a lot of Rate My Professor reviews.
Oh, sure.
But back in the day, it sort of was a combination of word of mouth.
Yeah.
You know, once I knew other graduate students there, you could kind of ask them like, hey, how's so-and-so, whatever. And I guess I was already ahead of my time in having the sort of, I don't know, SJW radar that someone like Jordan Peterson kind of talks about.
Can I ask what year we're talking about here?
Graduate school, we're talking 2003... or 4 to 6.
That was around when I started.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't make it to 2006. I dropped out before that. But yeah.
Yeah. But there's just certain things. I don't know how it is in different subject areas, but we didn't have Rate My Professors, but we had the websites of the university that had all the faculty members and told a little bit about their background and everything. And some of them you could just read. Like if it's like, oh, Professor so-and-so is an expert in 18th century gender fluidity, you know, blah, 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 all the right buzzwords
right.
like that. And I would just see that and go, and it was less that I was like, I'm opposed to that ideology as much as it was, that doesn't sound interesting to me.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I would see someone with more, like a more traditional history, you know, so-and-so is an expert on the dynamics of the imperialism of the British Empire. I'm like, that sounds cool.
Yeah. That sounds cool.
So I was able to get something out of it because I was, I guess, strategic.
What would you say at that point you were looking for? right? Because so you graduate an undergraduate program, bachelor's in history.
Yes.
Okay. So what are your career ambitions? Where are you pointing your focus as far as teaching history in the future is concerned at that point?
Right. Yeah. Well, like I said, I had a lot of really great professors in undergrad. I had some great ones in graduate school too, but in undergrad especially. And it was a classic case of they were really cool.
Yeah.
And I liked that setting because these were classes where it's a small liberal arts college. So most of your classes are like 15 students and there's much more interaction with the professors. There's no TAs.
Yeah. Sounds like we had a really similar undergraduate experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Where did you go for?
Southern Vermont College.
Southern Vermont. Okay.
In Bennington, Vermont.
Okay.
Yeah. Where were you?
Flagler College.
Flagler, in Florida, in
the town that I live in now, that I've lived in for a long time.
Is it St. Augustine? Is that where it is?
You've got it.
Oh, wow. Very cool. Isn't that the first settlement in Florida?
The first continuously occupied European settlement in North America.
Oh, indeed. Yeah.
40 some years earlier than Jamestown.
Yep. Yeah.
We've got a great, Coquina Spanish fort there.
That's right. Yeah.
It's completely unlike the rest of Florida as far as that goes. You know, lots of cool history. So much of Florida is only built in since World War II.
Right.
But St. Augustine's been there forever.
So after the show, my high school girlfriend went to Flagler, right? So was probably there when you were there. That's interesting.
Wow. Yeah. I was at Flagler from 2000 to 2003.
Then no. Never mind. Okay. But wait. Flagler was undergrad, right?
Undergrad, yeah.
Okay. Where'd you go to graduate school?
University of Tennessee.
So you're kind of narrowing in on any aspect of history by the end of that?
Yeah. By the time I was going to graduate school, I had zeroed in on I wanted to study the British Empire.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. So in graduate school, I did a non-thesis MA degree because I still had the urge to study a variety of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the option of a thesis MA or a non-thesis MA. And if you do a thesis MA, you end up being a little more specialized.
Mm-hmm.
You end up having to devote more of your time to your thesis, and you're a little bit more constricted, and you have to stay more in like your sub-discipline niche.
Right.
But with a non-thesis, you could be more of a generalist.
Yeah.
And you have like a primary field and a secondary field. So my primary field was modern Britain and the British Empire. And my secondary field was United States history. So, yeah, that's what I was doing at University of Tennessee.
And do you take, like, all right, so when I was an undergrad and I had the history, it was a history professor, I've talked about this on my show, who really changed my whole attitude, not just about my own ability, my whole attitude towards education, certainly my whole attitude towards history. It was my least favorite subject in high school. Mm. I hated it. And he just brought so much energy and knowledge into it. I mean, he had a set of political beliefs that I would later disagree with. I've tried to actually reach out to him and get him on the show. And I think he's maybe taken a couple looks at the website and said, I created a monster, you know. But that was a real turning point for me. And I remember it was a challenge because I don't think I was as developed a critical thinker as you were at that point in your life, encountering that material. So I felt like I was taking on a lot of his attitudes, but I was bringing lots of biases into things like, the study of the Civil War, name a topic in Western Civ, like the things that I remember really being immersed into in his classes. Is that normal that a college professor just begins his career with another agenda besides reporting the best story that he can kind of bring together? Because your study was obviously connected to or influenced by a belief system, right?
Well, kind of. I don't think that it originally was as much.
Okay.
Because actually what made me transition from being kind of a vague, you know, I guess sort of small government conservative, but who thought the war on drugs was bullshit, to an outright anarchist, was actually the study of history itself. So it was history itself made me an anarchist.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I'd love to hear about that.
Okay. Well, what happened was I kept seeing certain patterns in regard to power.
Yeah.
And I think part of the advantage I had there was because since I was doing a more generalized study of a bunch of different things, so many people in academia are in their own little silo.
Mm-hmm.
And they know all this like super specific specialized stuff about one micro topic. But we used to have more historians who were those sort of general purpose historians, like the history equivalent of a general practitioner doctor, right?
Sure.
And now what we've mostly got, at least in formal academia, is everyone's like, you know, just a podiatrist or that sort of thing. And
right.
like hardly anyone's around who's putting the big picture together. So
right. Yeah. I mean, because on the surface, it sounds better, right? Specialization in a field like that sounds like it would be better. I mean, obviously, a person studying history has to take all of these disparate courses, you know, that are seemingly unrelated. And granted, right. you can make some connections. But yeah, drawing out like the Will Durant style, right? The lessons right. of history. Like, yeah, a lot of people would lose that. They would lose that. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you need both. You need the specialist and the generalist, just like with doctors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want a general practitioner doing some really intricate brain surgery on you.
Right.
You want
right.
the guy who, like, the brain surgery is his bag.
Mm-hmm.
And you need the specialists because they often are the ones doing the important sort of cutting-edge primary research.
Right.
But I think you also need the people who are able to take a step back and kind of put things into more of a context. And also identify patterns and parallels and connections and things like that. I think that's where my strength lies as a history podcaster. I think, you know, part of it is I think I'm good at just talking about stuff. But I think I've got a skill at synthesis.
Right.
At putting together dots that other people haven't put together yet.
And what's the process like? I mean, how do you develop that skill? Because it's obviously a very important skill. It's funny. I was putting similar questions to Scott Horton yesterday, who kind of synthesizes a picture on a daily basis, right?
Yes.
And it's funny that we actually ventured briefly into British history, the history of the empire from kind of a conspiratorial angle.
Yeah.
He went through that period. And I think that's very interesting. Maybe we can get to that as well. But that's always something that's of interest to me when I see somebody who is you know, a smart person trying to solve a challenging problem. I think that's what I said to Scott. How does that process work for you? Like, if you were to pick it up and hand it or try to hand it to somebody else, what are the steps in synthesizing?
Okay, well, you have to start with a topic that you think would make an interesting podcast episode or perhaps 50-part series.
You're right.
And I guess to some degree, it's a process I just kind of learned by doing research projects as a student in the history programs I was in. You start with, all right, I want to learn more about this topic and put together a paper when I was a student or a podcast series now. So the next step is what's out there in terms of sources
mm-hmm.
on that. And, you know, it's kind of hard to explain. Some of it I'm probably using a little bit of shortcuts and heuristics, but identifying what sources would be the most helpful and then collecting those
mm-hmm.
and then going through them. And then it's a matter of, and this, you know, probably sounds a lot like sort of trivium type stuff going through, let's say, I don't know, you got six different books on the Spanish-American War.
Right.
They're not all going to line up with each other 100%.
Sure.
They will, if they're competent books, they're going to line up on the basic facts,
mm-hmm.
when things happen and whatever, people's names. But they're all going to be describing parts of the elephant.
Right.
And they're not all going to equally describe all the different parts of the elephant. And so what I would do is go through and, first off, try and figure out the overall point of view from which each of the books is coming from.
Okay.
And so, you know, is this an establishment sort of book or is it an anti-establishment book? Is it pro any particular, you know, individual or party in history? You know, is it a book where like they're clearly in the bag for Teddy Roosevelt or is it a book where they're kind of bashing Teddy Roosevelt, right?
Right. So either one could be like a great man treatment, right? Great,
yeah.
great in impact, but it's kind of built around. I felt like a lot of the history that I learned in higher education was built around the great man theory. I mean, some of it was like social movements, but if I looked at the organization of my notes for any U.S. history course, it was by presidential administrations, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
so
exactly.
That was kind of what defined the time in the mind of the professors that I had.
Yeah, yeah. And I still use that to some extent just because it's a convenient way to sort of organize things and
It's a demarcation that's useful. Yeah,
break up the rhythms that way. But so I'm collecting books or articles or whatever's out there, trying to evaluate the quality, because sometimes, you know, and again, it's a heuristic. It's not always going to work correctly. But in general, if something is a academically published book in its history, it probably has been fact-checked pretty well.
Sure.
Like, there's probably not major factual errors in there. I mean, occasionally it happens, but it's rare.
Okay.
So probably what's in there is factual, but it may not be the whole story. Or it may be factual, but there's a slant. And so I'm pretty good, because of, you know, so many years of doing this, at figuring out, like, where someone's slant is.
So to a novice, give an example of how a book is a collection of facts, but the author manages to work in a slant.
Yeah, and I mean,
because I totally know what you're talking about, and these books are are everywhere. Yeah, like, but how you spot that?
Okay, well, you spot it. I guess it requires some knowledge of the history and of the historiography.
Yeah.
So, if there's certain things, like, for example, Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
Who I'm going to be hitting with a series soon.
Okay, awesome.
If an author is covering Woodrow Wilson, and they either leave out or kind of become apologists for or downplay some of the darker sides of the Wilson administration. And I don't even mean the stuff that we would consider darker sides, like the Federal Reserve and whatever, but even setting aside the stuff.
The racism.
You know, the stuff that even the mainstream would consider problematic, you know, the assaults on civil liberties during World War I. The racist aspects of them, these sorts of things. If an author is covering Woodrow Wilson and they either leave that stuff out or they just kind of barely touch on it and quickly explain it away and justify it, well, okay, then you're looking at someone who's, you know, pro-Wilson on some level.
Right, absolutely.
Whereas if they're really pointing these things out and putting a spotlight on them, then you're dealing with someone who is not pro-Wilson. I suppose they could just be like a fair, objective person, or they could be anti-Wilson.
Right.
And then you have to look into also why are they one way or the other, right? So a communist could write a book about Woodrow Wilson where Woodrow Wilson sucks because he's not a communist.
Sure, yeah.
It would be very different from the book that you or I might write about Woodrow Wilson
and saying why he sucks. Yeah, exactly, right.
So, you know, you have to take into account not just the stance of the source, but like the reasoning behind it.
Right. Yeah. I was asking for, some of those cases that are a little more gray areas, right? Like Tom DeLorenzo wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
It's clear where he's coming from, right?
Yes.
Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln. It's
clear
where she's coming from.
Yes.
Right. You know, like if you look at her collection of work, it's obvious that she's very into the great man theory, and many men who we do not think are great, she has decided are very, very great. So sometimes it's extremely explicit, but I would think a lot of the times, especially when you get into more academic work like you do, it requires a bit of precision and a closer watch to.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a pop book, you know, that's like John Adams, those kinds of things. It's very clear. It's presenting something to a broad audience where the name and the title of the book is a heroic figure, right?
Yes.
Even if, you know, challenged or flawed or, you know, complicated,
right,
emerges from the story as a hero. But I would think in some of the work that you're looking at, that's not as easy to find.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a different tone and a different approach for academic books. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I sort of see what I'm doing as I'm kind of like a bridge where on some level, I mean, most of the sources I look at for my research are actual academic sources.
Right.
You know, I like primary sources when I can get a hold of them, you know, get access to them, but it's not always available. I can't travel to some archive on the other side of the country whenever I feel like it, at least not at this point. But the academic history books, again, they might have an ideological slant to them, but there are more rigorous standards of things like facts and fact checking, and more rigorous stances of or standards for things like footnotes.
Okay.
For example, so I spend a lot of time looking at footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
I spend a lot of time sort of like tracking down the trail of breadcrumbs. You know, you read this one book about something, and maybe hiding in one obscure footnote is a reference to some source that like can potentially blow your paradigm of what you think about this thing.
Sure.
And so I spend a lot of time kind of doing that. And then also, again, there'll be pieces of the story in one book, but not in the other, and vice versa. And so synthesis, really amounts to you're figuring out like where the parts of one book maybe fill in the gaps left by the other book.
Right.
And when there are discrepancies, and there's usually in an academic history book, there's usually not discrepancies of outright fact, but there might be extreme discrepancies of interpretation and meaning.
Right. I gotcha.
So then that what you do with synthesis there is try and figure out of the different sources you're looking at, which, if any of them, do you think has what seems to be the most correct interpretation based on the full picture of what you're seeing in a bunch of different books about the same or similar thing.
I gotcha. Absolutely. So how do you record and track your discoveries in this process?
You mean like in terms of note taking?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't really be able to walk away from a book like that with much more than essences. Right.
Mm.
But you need details in many cases, and you know, maybe your mind works in a way that mine doesn't, but I feel like I need all of this stuff logged and tracked. So I didn't know if you had some kind of process for doing a comparison between, you know, two pieces on the same subject.
Yeah, well, you know, it probably would be better for me to be more systematic about this, but I do kind of have my own sort of ad hoc system that would probably not make much sense to anyone else.
Right.
But if it's a book that I own,
mm-hmm.
I actually take my notes in the book.
Okay.
I did this a little bit before I went to college, but I really got big into this in college. You know, lots of underlining, margin notes, those sorts of things. If there's something in a book, like just one particular point in it that I really think is useful for somewhere else, I'll, you know, mark it up and even like fold a corner down at the bottom or whatever. So I like to actually take my notes on the book when possible, unless if it's a book I've borrowed from a library or from somebody else or whatever, then I'll actually have a notebook. I'll try to think about as I'm doing it based on what it is I'm trying to cover in the podcast. I'll try to think about, all right, there's a lot of information in this book. And for a history dork like me, probably a huge amount of it is interesting.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And a huge amount of it seems potentially important, but in order to avoid either underlining the whole book or taking notes that are just like the whole book, you know, verbatim, I've got to make the judgment call of what's really important to what it is I'm trying to figure out and then be able to explain in the podcast.
Now, do you prep before reading in like a Mortimer Adler fashion, you know, like going through the, being very clear about what your goal is for a particular book, or, you know, how much time do you spend in the index, the table of contents, the researching the author?
Yes.
Any of those things.
All the above.
Yeah.
All the above. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I just read How to Read a Book.
Oh, yeah?
For the first time earlier this year.
Mm.
It's one of those, you know, like a million other books that I had heard of for a long time but never actually read.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And what's funny is when I was reading that, a lot of those sorts of things that they talk about in there, it's stuff that I had already been doing.
Sure.
On my own. But, you know, I did pick up a few new, you know, strategies and things that are helpful. But, you know, I had a similar experience when I was in college. I worked for Kaplan. I was teaching test prep courses.
Yeah.
I'm what they call a natural test taker. I do very well on tests.
Right.
And I'm just very good at sort of gaming the test and figuring out, you know, using all those weird strategies they teach you at Kaplan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All those things were things I just did naturally. I just kind of on my own figured out how to do them. And so I had a similar experience to when I read how to read a book when I was teaching for Kaplan. And they had, you know, their curricula of all these strategies, you know, all these different like process of elimination strategies and ways to figure out which answers are clearly the wrong ones and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same thing where I was like, oh, here's someone explicitly, systematically explaining all the things that I had just organically just figured out on my own. So it was a similar thing when I read How to Read a Book. I was like, oh, this is, and you know, I actually did have a couple of professors in college who I don't know if they had read How to Read a Book, but they actually would share with the students certain things that maybe weren't exactly the same as how to read a book, but were kind of similar strategies of how to really kind of take usefulness out of a book.
I found it was kind of like confirming the usefulness of strategies that I had developed to compensate for laziness.
Ah,
right. Yeah. So like if I remember like dropping big books in front of myself because I had real high level of interest in extracting the information from them.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, oh, well, I really have time to go through this whole book. I'm not a professional. I'm not getting paid to do this. Why am I even doing this? Mm-hmm. And I mean, like I was a history teacher for a couple of years in a secondary school. But yeah, so I would just say, all right, well, let's start with the table of contents and get a lay of the land, and then let's go to the index and make sure there's enough depth on, you know, I had a goal for going into this book. So the index will tell me if I've got 3 to 5 subjects that are worth exploring. Is this the right book based on how much depth there is? How many pages cover these things?
Yes.
You know, that's, those were just hacks because sometimes I didn't want to open a book and start on page one and end when it says the end.
Yeah.
I would have to think that you would be coming across things in your profession all the time that you just wouldn't have time to do that with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I developed some of those approaches for almost sort of the opposite reason. My natural tendency is if it's a book that's remotely interesting to me, my natural tendency is I want to read the whole thing start to finish. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
And so it's the other way around for me where like I would get bogged down in time because my natural urge is to read very carefully in kind of a straight ahead fashion. And I'd say, oh, I can't. If I do this, I'll never finish all the books I need to read on time.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is that sometimes the approach would be to, I don't know, there were books where I was like, this book is going to change my life. So now we're not talking about history books anymore, but like, this is a book that is going to be absolutely transformative. And I would take it and speed through it once, right, to kind of capture the big picture of it. And then I would go back, kind of making some mental notes or seeing when things were really impactful. And then I would go back through with a highlighter and making notes in the margin. But that was a big time investment. I assume when you have to do this over and over and over and over again, that's just not a realistic way to engage with a lot of books.
No. So whether I've got the books, if they're mine and I've marked them up, or if I've done some notes in a notebook, if it's borrowed books that aren't mine to write on, then on some level, the most challenging part of my pre-recording an episode is I guess in trivia terms, it'd probably be the logic part where, okay, you've accumulated all these different tidbits that you can then compare and contrast. So you got to do that. But the other thing is, because it's a podcast, and you know, this is obviously applies to solo episodes, not to interview type episodes as much. But you know, when you're doing a long narrative solo thing, whether it's history or something else, if you want it to be good and to make sense and for it to be something that people can follow, you know, as they're driving to work or whatever it is they're doing, you need to have it organized in a way that makes sense, both from the standpoint of, cause there's kind of two things going on. In order to do this reasonably well, you have to simultaneously be teaching and storytelling.
Exactly.
So you have you have to take both into account. You know, oh, I have this information and these points that I want to get across, but simultaneously, I want this to be interesting. I want people to listen to it. Not really like, oh, this is some boring shit, but I really want to learn what's in this, but to for it to be painless, as painless as possible learning. So that's actually often the most challenging step in the process for me, is that kind of step where figuring out how to organize this, how to tie it together, you know, what topics am I going to cover? How am I going to, you know, connect these things together, segue from one topic to the next?
It's a special challenge, I think, when, for me anyway, coming from a world of history, like in public school, where storytelling was prioritized over the reporting of facts that were collected from a sound critical thinking process of comparing and contrasting, right? Like something was deliberately picked for having some kind of purpose, right? Names were changed, stories were bent, you know, all of those things. I mean, we could list 100 examples of that from American history, from a colonial history, but colonial and pre-colonial history of the United States. All those stories are legends, right? That serve a purpose.
You mean like Washington and the cherry tree and those sorts of...
Even things that Paul Revere's ride. Like Washington's cherry tree is obviously, you know, it's clearly mythology once you're 12 or 13. But the ride of Paul Revere.
Yep.
Like that, the story isn't about Paul Revere, you know, it's about somebody else. His name wasn't really rhymable with stuff.
You're talking about the...
I forget his name.
Israel Bissell.
Israel, was his name as simple as Bissell?
Israel Bissell, yeah. And I remember that because, I can't remember the comedian's name. Robert Wool. Oh, there you go.
Yeah. He talks about that in like an HBO special.
Yeah, I just remember, I can't take credit for this joke. He said something like, Israel Bissell, he sounds like he's a Jewish vacuum cleaner.
Exactly, right, yeah.
And it doesn't rhyme with very many things like Paul Revere does.
Right,
know?
Yeah, Paul Revere is very useful.
Yeah, and Paul Revere is, he's really kind of a failure when it comes to his Midnight Ride. He didn't make it all the way to Concord.
He didn't make it anywhere. He just went around town.
He made it to Lexington, I think, right?
Oh, no. I think in that telling of the story, because it came from a Longfellow poem, I want to say, the whole legend of Paul Revere. I think he just did a few blocks, you know.
I probably covered this in detail when I did the American Revolution years ago on my podcast. I thought he made it to Lexington, but not all the way to Concord.
Okay. That's not a bad ride from Boston.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Even with the roads of back then.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have the
they might have been better than they are now, actually.
Yeah. They didn't have the federal government there to build nice roads.
The other example I was thinking was Squanto. Squanto the Indian, who was like kidnapped and brought to Europe. And it's never explained. I mean, no one ever asked, I guess, in elementary school why the helper of the pilgrims knows English.
Right.
And it kind of, there was this... It disrupts the legend if you know that Europeans were there ahead of the Mayflower,
right,
fishing and maybe kidnapping people sometimes.
And definitely spreading smallpox.
And spreading disease that killed everyone that Squanto knew.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever seen the Charlie Brown Thanksgiving thing where they have the Charlie Brown characters as like the pilgrims?
I must have, yeah.
It's such complete like just propaganda mythologizing. They have it where the pilgrims show up and they're like, wow, aren't we lucky, and isn't Providence looking out for us that we showed up and there's all these empty farm fields that have been planted and all these, you know, like just all these resources waiting for us with no one around.
Yeah.
And they never at all even imply like, yeah, that's because everybody died of smallpox and malaria or not malaria, but, you know, yellow fever or plague or whatever. And they just kind of put it right into the nationalist mythology of in Charlie Brown, I guess they do kind of say it because it was made, you know, 50 years ago or whatever. They do get kind of like, well, the Almighty must have destined us to found this community or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, because they got pretty religious on some of those old Charlie Browns, you know, and whatever, like that Christmas one. But, you know, it's classic kind of like civil religion of what would be in like a 1950s school textbook.
The result, though, is such a robbery, you know, for, you know, really from the minds and the potential enthusiasm of children, right? Like, what a fascinating story that this man is kidnapped by, I think, British fishermen, brought to Europe, taught English, tries to work his way back, doesn't make it, winds up back in Europe, and then eventually gets home. You know,
and his whole civilization is almost wiped out.
And his whole civilization is gone. And I mean, it is an amazing story. Imagine that as a movie, but it's sanitized just out of the sort of founding of America legend because it raises too many questions. But those questions could, you know, maybe it doesn't happen for somebody when they're 7 or 8. But if that story was brought back, like in middle school, in high school, and elaborated on, like, okay, who was Squanto? Do you guys ever have any questions about this weird man, like it's, you know, something from a Disney movie and he's just there. But that never happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a huge opportunity is missed in stories like that. And there are probably so many, there's probably countless stories like that in American history alone. Casualties of a kind of sanitization, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And just in general, simplification.
Indeed.
And maybe it's something kind of a dark streak in my personality. But I find that disturbing stuff is interesting.
Indeed.
And, you know, stories of like the government doing horrible stuff to people, you know, whatever it is, MKUltra or Tuskegee or the Federal Reserve ripping us all off through inflation or whatever. I mean, just to me, that's just interesting. Aside from even setting aside like my own, you know, emotional response to it and being like, this is wrong and I wish more people knew about it. But just from a pure storytelling point of view, it's interesting stuff. I mean, you know, when you read something like Creature from Jekyll Island, And you get the real story on all these bankers conspiring to create the Federal Reserve and then acting like it's this progressive reform for the public interest or whatever.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's like something out of a clandestine novel or whatever.
Indeed. So, you know, that being said, I have an elevator story that I have to tell over and over and over again on my show, especially when I do interviews with people or when I'm being interviewed about the history of public school. Mm-hmm. Do you have an elevator story for that? I know I listened to one of your recent shows where you were talking to, I think he was a current public school teacher, maybe a former public school teacher. It's pretty recently, like last 10 episodes ago or 10 episodes ago. Or so.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mike K.
Mike K. Yep.
Yep.
I'm interested in your telling of that story. It's a kind of a way of us comparing notes here. I'm wondering how you'd synopsize that for somebody.
It would probably be pretty similar to how you've covered it.
Yeah.
You know, I think in, I guess more of your early episodes when you were doing that.
Yeah.
Before you moved to the kind of what to do next step.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Yeah. I mean, it probably wouldn't be very different than how you would cover it as far as the Prussian influence and then the turn of the century progressives kind of amping up some of the negative aspects of that even further. The John Dewey types, I mean, I don't want to make it all about a couple of guys.
Indeed, but, right, yeah.
But, you know, those types.
Right,
those
types. Sure.
All those other guys that, like, Gatto mentions who were sort of in that milieu at the turn of the century, into the mid-20th century. And certainly a lot of those corporate foundations mm-hmm. are a big part of it, the Rockefeller Foundation and all those. People don't ask the question very often, like, who actually comes up with these curricula, you know, when they're like, oh, here's the new way we're going to teach math, or the new, who actually came up with that? Where were they? Who was funding them? Why did they come to the conclusions they did about, oh, let's not do phonics anymore. Let's do this.
Yeah.
And then there's ideological stuff going on, but there's also the kind of public interest corporate welfare stuff where, you know, some company's got a particular line of standardized tests that they would like to sell.
Sure.
And so they then get the politicians to gear the curricula towards that.
Or they're interested in some kind of outcome, you know, some kind of social or economic outcome from what's going into the school. So, I mean, the Rockefellers get involved in funding Dewey at Columbia because it's like, oh, you're trying to figure out how to put everybody in a mold and get, you know, a certain outcome. Well, here's some money. Let us know what you find. We'd be interested. Yeah. So you see people kind of working towards the same thing, maybe for entirely different reasons. I think Dewey was very idealistic. I think he had a vision of what he thought was a better society. I think he's kind of turned into a more nefarious character than he actually was. I mean, he's kind of measured exclusively by the results and not so much by what his intentions were.
Well, I guess whether his intentions were good or not so good, it kind of... Even setting aside judging it by results, it also would kind of depend on your own values and ideology, because there's no question he was a hardcore collectivist.
Oh, of course.
He's got all those quotes about, you know, oh, I believe education is really about absorbing the child into the collective race or whatever, you know, all those sorts of statements he made along those lines. So, you know, I would still see him as a nefarious character, other than in the sense that I'm sure he did not see himself in that line.
Right.
Yeah, but I would still see him as nefarious. Just because I'm against that type of collectivism.
So you say you like to tell these stories, right? Where you can find a wrong that's being done and kind of showcase it. You had a positive view of the story as far as maybe the usefulness of the story, where there is a wrong that is done. There is a kind of a shock value to that as far as like presenting to students.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so definitely, you know, when you're talking to mostly 18 and 19-year-olds, as you know, they do respond to the basic idea of you've been lied to. Or at the very least, a big part of the truth has been withheld from you.
Yeah.
Here's some neat stuff that's like, it's not secret, but it might as well be secret, because hardly anyone knows it, even though you could look it up.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I talk to my students about, like, COINTELPRO... It's amazing what I'm able to get away with in class that you wouldn't expect, but I'm lucky that where I teach the actual faculty member, we're not very like micromanaged by anybody.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of the style of the administrators, I guess. They just sort of, you know, mostly leave you alone. And so I'm able to do U.S. history my way. So, you know, we obviously have to cover some of the standard stuff just because it's in the course outline, but we're not micromanaged nearly as much as a K through 12 teacher would be.
Sure.
So, and our course outlines are very kind of open-ended and vague. So, there'll be like, for example, a point in the outline that says, cover World War II.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That doesn't say what I right. So guess what? You know, we're gonna get into why the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki may have been completely unnecessary and, you know, unnecessary from the point of view of, oh, the Japanese would have never surrendered without that, you know.
Right. So one of the things that I noticed about, and I'm sure you've noticed this too, about the whole you've been lied to narrative or container for teaching history, right, is it can be incredibly poisonous because it's a way that a lot of college professors can build trust with students as like they've showed them some kind of a revelation.
Yeah.
Right. And then through that trust, they can use, they can push a political agenda. Right. They will also, in my case anyway, it was almost automatically accepted as truth. Mm. This guy knew that I had been lied to about all this other stuff, that so much of the history that I got in, you know, certainly elementary school. And then I felt like elementary school was where they kind of really push the message, right? Like you're really indoctrinated there. And then in middle school and high school, it's kind of like, oh, this is so boring that you don't really have to worry about it again.
It's mostly very boring.
Yeah. But that initial contact with the subject of history and the sort of legends of America, that's pretty firmly in place for most people at that point. And then once those legends aren't going to work anymore, it just becomes sort of worksheet and dates and names time for the rest of public school.
Yeah. No.
I wanted to ask you, though, like, while we're still on the subject of these things, what's your favorite story to tell students, or what have you had the best results with from any, you know, area of the study of history, that kind of co-intel, that exposure, right? What is either your favorite to tell, maybe they're the same, or the one that you found to be the most impactful as far as like engaging students?
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of hard to say. I guess I'd have to say overall, probably the one that has the most like visible impact on many of them is in U.S. History 2, which is the most popular class because it's the gen ed history class.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the one that like almost everybody takes. In U.S. History 2, after we cover World War I, then I give them War is a Racket. And they have to read War is a Racket, and then we come in the next class and we just have a discussion. I don't go Socratic that much because I have so much stuff I have to cover. It's because it's like intro-level survey classes, but that's one of the classes where I go Socratic and just ask them about War as a Racket and leverage that into discussion. And War as a Racket seems to really resonate with them. I think in part because it's written in a very straightforward fashion. It's very, very easy to read and understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, dense founding father, you know, writing or something. And also the fact that it's one of the most decorated Marines in American history who's saying all this,
right. It
packs a punch. And I'm teaching at a small town in a fairly rural part of the South. I'm in North Florida, which is the more southern part of Florida, culturally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my students are military veterans, the older ones, who are not the typical 18-year-olds. And presumably a lot of the 18-year-olds are people seriously considering going into the military.
Right,
like there's just tons of military people in the area. And it's amazing. You know, you might assume that this would piss them off, that I would have them read War as a Racket. But precisely the opposite. The veterans usually love it more than anybody.
And that's interesting. You know, we were talking about this last night. I was talking about this with a military veteran, the movies that veterans love, right? Titles that would maybe surprise you, like Full Metal Jacket, Platoon. These are not, you know, because that it's saying something that, or it's bringing into reality or awareness something that maybe in many cases is very hard to put into words for people who experience it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, from my experience talking to a lot of people who were in the military and wound up in this whole scene,
right?
When something is able to do that effectively and concisely, like War is a Racket is incredible. It's startling for me when I read it.
Yeah.
Like I was 2 years into being a libertarian, or at least 1 year into it, and I had been like a conspiracy theorist, InfoWars guy before that.
Mm-hmm.
It was still really, really a startling thing to read, considering the source and considering just how blunt he was.
Yeah. If that same sort of thing was written by, you know, some some left-wing socialist professor somewhere,
right,
no one would particularly care.
Exactly,
but,
sure.
But it's coming from one of the most decorated, you know, war heroes in American history. And in general, most – and I have so many veterans come through my classes, and the vast majority of them – love my class. And like, I'm very skeptical about all the wars in class. I'm, you know, exposing like the real stuff about the origins of these wars, like the real ulterior motives going on. You know, get into things like the Gulf of Tonkin incident and, the USS Maine, which is, did a huge, huge podcast about it, way more depth than I ever would get into in class. About the origins of the Spanish American War.
And this was like almost 4 hours, yeah, 3 or 4 hours.
Hours and change. Yeah. It's a beast. And, again, you would think, based on kind of superficially thinking about it, like, oh, a lot of the veterans are going to get, you know, really pissed off and offended that I'm calling into question Team America's wars.
Right.
90% of them are like very amenable to what I'm saying. And a huge number of veterans coming through my classes, they love my class. They're the students that will like hang out and chat with me after class or in my office hours or something like that. And they want to tell me their personal stories that go along with these sorts of critiques.
Absolutely.
Of how the system works.
Right.
And I think part of it is that I don't pander to them. I don't patronize them. I don't immediately, you know, start worshiping the ideal of them and go, oh, thank you for your service and blah, blah, blah. I've had a lot of veterans tell me like, they can't stand it. And I'm sure not all veterans are this way, but a lot of veterans, they kind of don't like it when people are like worshiping the ideal of veteran and like being all, thank you for your service and pandering and patronizing.
Right.
And,
sure.
And I just treat him like a person. You know, I don't treat him any different than any other student. And they seem to appreciate that. And I've had them, many of them say things to me like at the end of the semester, like, you know, I really appreciated your class, that it wasn't all just a bunch of bullshit.
Mm.
That like, you know, you really tried to dig in things and get it what's really going on. So, yeah, that's probably Smedley Butler is the thing that's packed the biggest punch over the years.
How do you, before you introduce something like that, how do you alert people in your class to maybe your worldview? Mm-hmm. Do you expect it to come through like subtly but consistently? Or do you have some kind of a session where you say, you know, these are the things that kind of influence the way that I see history, that I see the world, that I see politics?
Yeah.
Because I never had that experience in undergrad or graduate school. I mean, I was in graduate school, not for history, but for education.
Mm.
These people were nuts, you know, and as far as their political beliefs, and they never explicitly stated any of how their worldview or their attitudes towards education or the profession of teaching, like what informed it. None of that was all invisible. It was presented as if it was unbiased truth, right? Mm.
Yes.
And nothing is. Certainly in that discipline where I was pursuing a graduate degree, and it's probably even less the case in history. So.
Yeah. Let me think how to put this. The way that I deal with that is kind of like what you were alluding to. I have, very often I'll have sort of a portion of class towards the beginning of the semester where I kind of go over a little bit of where I'm coming from, because to me, I'm not a believer in the idea that there is such a thing as objective history.
Right.
I think, but I can't prove. So I guess I'm vaguely agnostic, but I think that there is such a thing as objective reality.
Okay, I agree.
But I don't think there can be such a thing as objective history, because history is a depiction and recreation of the past. It's not the past. It's
right.
A depiction of the past. And the depiction is coming through human beings who are the ones collecting the sources, putting them together, and figuring out how to connect it all and describe it.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the intellectually honest thing, whether it's someone who's writing a history book or teaching a history class, is to somewhere towards the beginning of things, go over, look, this is kind of where I'm coming from ideologically. I'm not going to pretend to be unbiased, because that would be dishonest.
Right.
And anyone, I think anyone who says, oh, my version of history is objective and is the truth with a capital T, they're either, you know, fools who don't understand what all this means, or they're kind of being intellectually dishonest, and they're trying to, you know, they're going to give you their ideology, but they're going to tell you it's the objective truth.
Absolutely. Which is mostly what I encountered. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually, And I sort of explain it to them, you know, how I'm saying it now, where I basically say, look, you know, I actually go over this whole idea that, that history can't be objective.
Right.
Because it's a depiction of the past. It's not the past.
Right.
You know, the past happened, I think, anyway. I'm not a full-blown, you know, there is no objective reality person. But the depiction of it is in the same way that a painting or a photograph of something, even if it's done really realistically, is never the thing itself.
Yeah, of course.
And so even in a photograph, the photographer is making all of these judgment calls of, all right, how do I focus it? What do I put? How do I frame this?
Light.
All the little settings and everything like that. So even a photograph isn't objective.
You know, I mean, I've talked about it as history is kind of a scene in a movie, right? Mm-hmm. Now, something happens in that scene as far as the physical people who are involved and the things that they say. The presentation of that scene on film, once you involve the choices of the director and the cinematographer, you have almost infinite ways to present what actually happened.
Yes.
Right? The way, the height of the light, the distance of the camera, the amount of light, the angle of the camera. So many things can influence the way. And you know, good directors are very good at putting the camera in weird places to create odd feelings about, you know, normally mundane things in a scene in a movie.
I think that's a very good metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so, you know, I kind of go over that with them, and it's also something I've done in my podcast, you know, periodically. I don't hide where I'm coming from, but I also sort of say something like this. I'm not trying to convert you to a particular cause or party or belief.
Okay.
That the way I see my role is more like, I'm going to share some information with you that if I've done my job well, as I define it, it's going to be stuff you've never come across before in prior history classes or whatever, or stupid, you know, history shows on TV. And it's stuff that I've made the editorial judgment call is interesting.
Right.
And that I think on some level or another is important. You may disagree, but hey, I'm sort of the captain of this whole thing. So, hey, you know, but what you do with the information I'm going to share is ultimately up to you.
Right.
So I'm going to drop these facts on you. If it does change your overall ideology or worldview, if it doesn't, I don't see that as my job.
Right.
I see it as my job ends when I do my best to try and kind of just get people to learn new stuff and look at things in a different way than they did before. And I really made that a conscious thing in my teaching long before I started the podcast. At the end of my first year teaching college, I got back my student evaluations, and they were mostly pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But one student wrote something, and it really kind of bugged me. He wrote something, because it's mostly multiple choice little evaluations, but there's some spots where you can write in some of your own comments. And he wrote something like, yeah, the class was pretty good, but it wasn't much different from the world history classes I've already had two or three times in grade school. Like,
what?
You know?
Yeah.
So, but I was a rookie, so I hadn't evolved.
Right.
You
yeah.
know, my kind of unique style and voice of how to do it. But that really kind of hit me. I was like, I don't want my class to be that. I don't want my class to be, you know, the same shit that they heard in middle school or high school or whatever.
Right.
Or the same shit they just encounter on TV. And so from that point on, I made that one of my focuses. Like, I just want my class to be as different in terms of the sorts of topics we hit and the ways that we come at things than
Indeed.
What they've ever gotten before. And then it's up to the student to decide what to do with the information.
That's a really good way to put it, because I think what I struggled with teaching on a much simpler level, like I was teaching high school kids, but I was, you know, really kind of transporting my college experience. I was trying to transport this sort of eye-opening experience that I had in college studying history into this high school classroom. And one of the things that I really struggled with was the storytelling aspect with the comprehensiveness, right? So I had been in public school for 12 years, and everything gets covered step by step by step, or so you think, right? Mm-hmm. Chapter by chapter. It's chapter 12 in the history book, and then it's chapter 13. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't like reading the audience that I had or getting feedback from the audience that I had not just as an educator, but as a storyteller, and maybe shifting or prioritizing into things that would keep their interest. I felt like I'd try to go in there at the beginning of a class and say something interesting or you know, something
have
sort
a neat
of,
little anecdote or
like shocking, like, oh, did you guys know this? Well, I'm going to tell you about it today. But then I felt like I had a checklist of names and dates that I had to get through, so the whole story would make sense. You know, and I didn't realize that I could prioritize storytelling, and then it was up to them what they wanted to do with it. It seemed like my history teacher in the one that I liked the best that I had in college, he seemed to know, even though he was really, really detail oriented and into chronologies and, you know, filling in all of the best he could, or the best we could acknowledge anyway. He was trying to fill everything in the story. It was the way the stories were told that actually made me want to do something with it after I left college, right? So the podcast is like you can narrow in on, you know, one thing as much as you want, and there's all kinds of constraints that are removed, and it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that's what drew me to it, to ultimately starting it. It was one of those things I kind of thought about for a long time before I finally took the plunge. Right. And actually, your podcast was one of the ones that shortly before I started my podcast – I found your podcast and you were one of, I'd say like two or three of the podcasts that really made me kind of think I can do this and make something.
Right.
And the reason why yours really kind of resonated with me in that way was that you were just like some regular dude who had been a teacher. Like you weren't a guy who, you know, had been, you know, a celebrity already for something or had written a bunch of books or whatever. Like those sorts of people, they start a podcast. They already have an audience from whatever else they've done.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that you were some guy who was just, you know, some teacher and you know, started to have issues with that and started to do, you know, in-depth research and then just talking about it, I was like, oh, okay, I'm some guy too.
Right. I love that story. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to hear that. I did not know that.
Yeah. And the way that I started to think about it, I started to think about, and this is again storytelling, but it's kind of how we give everything we do significance. I started to think about all the teaching I'd been doing and all the things before it as far as just studying history. And I started studying history when I was like 12 or something. I just got interested in reading history books. It was weird for a 12-year-old freak. But I now look back in hindsight and I look at all that stuff before I started the podcast as essentially a version of like wax on, wax off. I was developing certain areas of knowledge and skills and I did not know what they would be for.
Yeah.
And then along comes this medium where it's like wide open. You can talk about whatever you want. And another of the podcasts that kind of really, really kind of inspired me was of course Dan Carlin.
Sure.
And just the fact that, you know, his views on things are a bit different from mine and his style's a little different, but he's very good at what he does, clearly. Mm-hmm. That's why he's as big as he is. And with him, it was just specifically that here's a history podcast that has an enormous following.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that can be a thing. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, sort of combine like, oh, a regular guy who's not famous from anything before can start a podcast and run with it. And then combine with, oh, here's a guy over here who does a history podcast. And it's like a big deal. And, you know, probably my show will never be as big as Dan Carlin's by a mile.
Right.
But, you know, it doesn't have to be. So yeah, those sorts of things. And then I kind of realized like, oh, I've been spending all this time learning all this shit and figuring out ways to explain it to people. And in a class setting, I mean, it's voluntary on the level of like students don't have to go to college.
Right.
But it's not voluntary really that they're in my class if they go, because 99% of them are just punching out gen ed credits.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's this weird kind of not really voluntary thing. And most of them are just in there. They just want to, you know, get through it as easy as possible and whatever. And so
is that that challenge? You've observed that you like that challenge of like, I know you're just wandering through here, but I'm going to get you.
Yeah. Some days I do. Some days I get kind of tired of it.
Okay.
You go in there and it's weird how sometimes the more problematic students from that point of view, you know, the more hostile audience, they'll often congregate somehow magically more into like one class versus another.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'll have say two US history classes in one day, and class A is like more than half the students are really at least somewhat interested and really kind of engaged without me having to drag them into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, another class later that day, and it's like all the just maybe shouldn't have even gone to college at all. I don't know, but for sure are coming in with just an attitude like they're going to the dentist. Like, I know this is going to suck and I'm determined to make sure it sucks.
Right.
So
right.
That, like,
right.
You know, no matter what this guy does, I'm determined to hate it. But you know, I realize that if you can actually get at least some of the people who come in there with a pretty bad attitude, and I don't blame them on some level because they probably had shitty history in middle school and high school.
Right.
So, but if I can make at least some of those people learn something and be interested and kind of get something out of it where they didn't expect it, I said, oh, well, the podcast, if people are tuning in voluntarily.
Yeah.
If they're not interested in it, they could just not listen to it.
Right.
So that's the other thing I've noticed is the dynamic is so much, you know, improved by that voluntariness, by the fact that no one is even indirectly required to listen to my podcast.
Yeah.
And so it's a much improved relationship with the audience. You know, it's sort of like if you're a comedian, you get the advantage of people come to a comedy club wanting to laugh.
Right. Most sure.
So you have that advantage that they're like, all right, you know, well, someone who downloads a history podcast, they're already at least somewhat amenable.
Yeah. And they're kind of rooting for you too, because they like your delivery of it. It's really nice. I like that. I've tried to think about ways with my show, and I wonder if you found any, to really embrace that kind of audience relationship more, to try and do something more interactive. And so my first attempt was a call-in show. There were the ratio of technical headaches to calls was not, you know, or was too high.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the tour, which was a life-changing experience. I went all across the country.
Yeah,
40 days.
That was really cool. You never came close enough for me to make it to one, but I was kind of jealous too. I've wanted to do, you know, just a road trip like that for a long time.
Yeah.
It's like,
me
sounds
too.
So cool.
Yeah.
I love road trips.
Yeah, and I can't even I could barely even go home. I went back to New Hampshire for like 2 months, and I was like, I'm leaving again. And
so are you like full on nomad now?
No, not really. I'm actually reset. I was not ever really nomading. I had kind of like staked out a central location in Pennsylvania, and I was trying to decide whether or not I wanted to move to Philadelphia or Pittsburgh. So I was driving back and forth between the two, and by your facial expression when I said Philadelphia, maybe you'd be happy to hear that I decided on Pittsburgh.
Well, you know, I haven't been there since I was a little kid. I'm in general, I'm rarely a fan of a really big city.
Yeah. And Pittsburgh Pittsburgh looks like a big city, but it feels like a wonderful neighborhood, right? When it's many wonderful neighborhoods and it's very neighborhood oriented and it has a really interesting history, and a lot of that big Carnegie money went to good use there. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those Rust Belt cities. I mean, Detroit, as I'm sure you know, is similar to that, where there's like all this neat old stuff that's still there as far as just like really, really neat architecture and you know, interesting like cultural stuff and museums and whatever that you wouldn't expect, because it's a town that like used to be bigger. It used to be a boom town.
Right, right.
And yeah, there's that interesting kind of like semi-slow motion collapse happening, which there's obviously bad aspects to it and less bad aspects to it, and some neat stuff too.
What's really cool about Pittsburgh is the people there, you know, they were saying 60 years ago, this city should be abandoned.
Yeah.
People shouldn't even live here.
Yeah.
You know, and you can see these old pictures or old films of the city just covered in smoke. Right.
Yeah.
It is so beautiful. Like the topography of Pittsburgh is, you know, it's this city on three rivers, basically, in between two of the rivers as they confluence into the third. And cities in between, and then to the south, there's all these big hills, right? And there's all these vistas, there's all these beautiful bridges. That was hidden in a cloud of smoke once, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't as beautiful then, obviously. A lot of the beautification took place after the smoke cleared.
Right.
But it, to me, what I saw is that, and I've looked at the history a little bit, it was a culture of people who cared about saving their city on their own, right?
Uh-huh.
There was no EPA. There was no National Guard, state of emergency. People decided community by community, from the best I can understand, that the city was disgusting and unhealthy. Mm. People would volunteer their time neighborhood by neighborhood. They'd pick a day. They'd scrape soot off the houses. People fought to preserve areas that they wanted to tear down and develop into condos or industrial parks. Mm. And, it's a very eclectic, very diverse place. You know, I was trying to choose when I was on my tour, I was trying to choose between six places to live. Once I decided on Pittsburgh, I realized I had like 13 new choices, right?
Yeah.
Because just the diversity from area to area that are sometimes carved out by ethnic groups or sometimes carved out by the sort of the institutions of a certain neighborhood, like Carnegie Mellon University is just an incredible place. But then there's downtown and there's the Mexican War Streets neighborhood, which is almost kind of like New Orleans. And all this is happening within a couple of square miles, you know? So it's really, really an amazing place. I have been there now a dozen times. And every time I get there, I go, oh my God, here we are. This is the most amazing place. Like when you can see the skyline and all the bridges, friends there. Even if I didn't have friends there, the culture there is really amazing. And it's a kind of stimulation that I need at this point in my life. Now, I lived in New Hampshire, but I grew up in New Hampshire. You know, I was a Free Stater. I moved away and then joined the Free State Project and moved back. But the best place to live in New Hampshire is where I grew up. And I'm a guy who can live anywhere because of my work. So I'd feel, I know this isn't the best way to think about it, but I'd feel like I was missing an opportunity if I settled when there were infinite, you know, many, many choices of desirable places to live, and I settled 15 minutes away from where I grew up.
Yeah,
I'd already spent so much time there.
No, that makes perfect sense. So, what have you noticed from the big road trip tour you did? Obviously, you know, the events and things themselves that you did and the time you spent with people, but like in terms of the I don't know, I guess the effect of that, the legacy of that, like did it. Has it noticeably made your audience larger? Has it noticeably made your audience more diehard? Has it? Can you tell? Or
I can only talk about the impact that it's had really on me so far. Like as far as any increase in listenership, I mean, it was a good promotional thing, and I got a few nice interview spots with like Tom Woods and Michael Malice afterwards. So doing a thing is a that is different and elaborate is a good way to promote what you already have.
It's like writing a new book if you're an author.
It was my book. A 9,000 mile book is a way to think about it. But for me, I feel like it was so much more satisfying, and I actually it took me back into working on the show and wanting to rebuild the show with a new kind of energy. Because, first of all, because it was something that put me outside of my comfort zone, right? And then I decided that was a very attractive place for me to be. The other thing is it put faces and personalities and sort of interpersonal connections to names.
That's one of the things I like about even something like this. You know, that we're at right now. Similar thing, obviously you did it across the whole country, so on a like next level as far as that goes, but it is cool at a thing like this or you know, any sort of like Liberty event or whatever, when some of your fans that you've interacted with online for years,
you
know, who are some of like the earliest diehard supporters of your show and whatever, to actually meet them face to face, it's very cool.
It was absolutely amazing, and it was motivational too. To kind of take those memories of the people back. But it was also how I got here, right? Because I am a New Hampshire guy. We have our own Summerfest happening this week that I've been attending 9 years in a row. when I was in Detroit, Joe Motard said, "Will you come to?" They did a nice sell, right? Like they brought me to the city. We had this awesome meetup at one of their houses, and late in the night after we had a great time recording a silly podcast, Joe said, "Will you come to the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest?" And I said, of course. Whatever. You want me to speak? And it's interesting. Then I got here, like I said to Joe, pick a topic for me. I'll, you know, since you've been such a good supporting listener, you decide what you want to hear me talk about and I'll do it. But then that didn't work out because he gave me some suggestions and I didn't want to do them. And when I got here, the thing that I wanted to do most was just Q&A, you know, back to that whole, the question about ways to embrace the relationship with the audience. Like, I just wanted to hear what's on your minds, you know, people who came to see me, like, what can I answer for you? Let's get uncomfortable. You know? So I'm really happy I came. I'm really happy I'm sticking around an extra day. This has just been completely awesome.
I love all the folks, at the fest. I was here in 2016 and then I couldn't make it last year. So, but, they really wanted me back. So, you know, they helped get me here, long way from Florida. And literally my summer school classes ended on Thursday. Friday morning, I was on a plane, you know, to get up here. So
I was treated really well, you know,
yeah.
and really encouraged and like, I had never been so excited, I think, to come to an event. Like, I had been asked to speak places before, but this was like, it really felt like I belonged here, you know, based on the experience that I had in Detroit.
And they
just took really good care of me. Like, Joe is working on my car right now, I think.
Wow.
So I am definitely coming back to this next year. This has been an awesome event.
Yeah. No, I agree. I've only been to Porkfest once.
Yeah.
And I've heard that it was like one of the like not great years to go anyway, that I kind of had bad luck, that like other previous years it's been cooler.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I like this one better. You know, maybe if I'd gone to Porkfest a long time ago, it would have been cooler, but I like the fact that it's a smaller event here. It's more personal. I don't know. I guess my personality, it's easier for me to interact with a smaller total number of people, I guess.
It's less overwhelming for an introvert too.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was kind of fishing around for.
Every 2 hours I just split and go. I usually go stand on the picnic table. For some reason, I don't know, it feels right to stand on a picnic table in front of my cabin just by myself for 20 minutes, and then I'm good, I'm recharged, and I can come back.
Yeah. I actually, and part of it was because I was up too late recording and imbibing with Lou last night. But before
a drunk history?
Yeah.
What did you guys talk about?
I don't remember, which means it's the real deal. And combine that with the fact that I'm old now and I don't stay up till 3 a.m. very often anymore.
Right.
So that just makes things worse. But I ended up, before my talk today, I laid on my back on the picnic table by the pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did meditation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Lying on my back, eyes closed.
Right.
I was lucky it was not raining at that point, as it was a little bit later.
Uh-huh.
I need that kind of stuff too. So I know exactly what you're talking about, where periodically you need a break just from the constant socialization. Not that there's anything wrong with the other people. They're all great people.
Oh, of course.
But if you're this type of personality, you just, you know, need little breaks.
Absolutely. I do feel like I could just walk up to any group of people that have kind of gathered together and insert myself into their conversation. I felt totally comfortable just going absolutely anywhere and saying, hi, my name's Brett. And,
I've had so many, you know, interesting conversations, you know, some with people that I remember from 2 years ago, and then, but new people as well. A lot of interesting stories, a lot of interesting backgrounds.
Yeah.
People are doing interesting things.
Have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like it's fun to just, you know, get with a group of people and get kind of silly.
Yep.
Like we did last night, we did the round table thing they do. Yeah. It was a train wreck of a show, but I had a great time doing it. It was wonderful. But I was thinking that this conversation is kind of an introduction of your work to for my audience, right? Even though we probably do have some overlap. But there's probably lots of conversations that we could have if we focused in on specific things. And I'd love to have you back on the show to do that in the near future. There's so many, I think so many topics in history, even just American history, where we feel similarly. But I'd really like to showcase the depth of your knowledge on some of these topics to my audience. I hope we can work together in the future, but has been a great conversation.
That sounds great. I guess we'll Skype.
Indeed. I guess we will. And what's your website?
Website is dangeroushistorypodcast.com.
Awesome.
And that'll get you to just kind of the homepage. And yeah, the podcast is Dangerous History. It's available wherever you like to get your podcasts.
Do you want people to start at the beginning, or how do you, what do you suggest?
No, actually, in my earliest episodes are now behind my Patreon paywall.
Yep.
I did that move. But no, I would say I've got a page that just lists all the episodes. Mm-hmm. And I would say scroll down that thing and look for what topics you're interested in.
Yeah.
And if there's something that grabs you, or if there's a topic like right off the bat you're interested in, I'm nearing the end of the Civil War right now.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone's just really into Civil War and they want to get like a more full picture of it than you normally get, go with that. I've done American Revolution. I did a long multi-part history on slavery a while ago. Lots of different stuff, even a few ancient and medieval topics every now and then.
Right.
You know, it's more modern, but I like to mix it up and do different stuff. So, yeah. Just go with whatever you're interested in. Take advantage of the fact that this is not a coercive curricular situation.
Indeed.
Where I am going to dictate, you must do these things this way in this order. And by all means, if you try my show and hate it, don't listen to it anymore. You'll be happier, I'll be happier. Everybody's better off.
CJ, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been awesome.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been my pleasure. It's been really cool to meet you.
And I just want to say thanks again to Brett for having me on School Sucks. It was really cool to meet him in person and have a nice long conversation and do so on the record. And again, to any of you who are listeners to my show who are not familiar with School Sucks, get over there ASAP and check it out. Thank you for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check out the website, profcj.org, or you can just put in dangeroushistorypodcast.com to get the show notes for this and every other Dangerous History Podcast episode. While you're there, you can email subscribe to the site over in the right-hand side, and if you put in your email address there and subscribe, you won't get any spam or anything like that from me, no junk email. You'll simply get an email notification every time something new is posted at my website. You can follow me and the show on Facebook and Twitter as well, and you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, however you prefer to consume your podcasts. If you enjoy and appreciate this show, there are many different ways you can help me keep this show going, growing, and constantly improving. One easy way is simply to spread the word about the Dangerous History Podcast to those you think might appreciate it who don't already know about it. And you can also help the show out by leaving ratings or reviews in venues such as iTunes, which helps the podcast get ranked more highly. If you would like to help out the show financially, there are many ways to do so, and you'll find them at profcj.org/donate. And one of the best, most helpful is to sign up to support the show via Patreon at patreon.com/profcj. And if you pledge a contribution of at least $5 per month or more, you'll have access to bonus episodes that I publish in Patreon available nowhere else, as well as the ability to join the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors private Facebook group. You can also make one-time or recurring donations via PayPal, and you can donate via Bitcoin as well. And of course, if you buy things from any of my Amazon affiliate links or my Abe Books affiliate links, go through those links, then do your shopping as normal, and the Dangerous History Podcast will get a small commission at no additional cost to you. This has been another episode of the Dangerous History Podcast, helping you learn the past so you can understand the present and prepare for the future.